You're born and raised in Sitka, right?
Right.
And you graduated, you went off to school, and really haven't been back for an extended period since, have you?
I spent about 5 months in 1999 writing for the Sentinel,
Okay.
actually. Yeah.
I don't think we'll have time to connect the dots between the Sentinel and the Sudan, but there is an awfully powerful Sitka connection now in the South Sudan,
Yeah.
right? Tell us about that.
South Sudan is the world's newest country. Became independent last year as a part of a peace deal, which ended a very long civil war with the North. And for a long time, the U.S. Agency for International Development, federal government's development agency, had been funding shortwave news and sort of civic education programs from Kenya into South Sudan. But when when the peace deal was signed, they went about a process of shifting the center of gravity of their media development programs to Juba, the capital of South Sudan. And at the time, I worked for USAID and was asked to go and evaluate the situation and design a media program for then the incipient new country. And so I designed a program which involved setting up a what we refer to as a learner's FM radio station. It's 1 kilowatt in Juba, because the country essentially had had no media education whatsoever. They had a sort of a fledgling university, but didn't have a program, and so there were no journalists to sort of take over the role of the media, perform the role of media in South Sudan. So the idea was that we needed both the journalistic activities to take place right away and for there to be an opportunity for journalists to learn on the job, not to go through necessarily a full 4-year program. And if you think about a lot of the journalists around the world, they picked it up, they studied science and then they got into media, or they studied economics and they got into media. So the program I designed was approved and funded for multiple years. They have a really nice studio, and just by chance, the person that the organization hired to do the work was John Newstrom.
And that was coincidence, you say.
Total coincidence.
Okay.
And sent.
Coincidence, but maybe not so, really, when you think about it.
Yeah. Oh, I had no role in the hiring of it. I just designed the program, and you sort of set the benchmarks and the numbers, and you set the budget size and stuff like that.
But if you look at people who are well versed in the mission that you're describing, I mean there's a limited pool of people who are out engaged in this activity in the world,
It's true.
and it is not unlikely that you're going to hit a John Newstrom,
It's true.
right?
John and I actually had been in touch. We both worked for an NGO called Internews, which was out of California. They do a lot of media development programs around the world, maybe in 40 countries or something. And I had been the country director for the Tajikistan operations, and he was running their Afghanistan operations. And by chance, the woman in Uzbekistan to the north of Tajikistan, to the northwest, was from Fairbanks. So sort of an axis of Alaska in Central Asia for media development. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then crazily enough, I think within the past 6 months or so, John is brought in as a consultant into South Sudan, Mr. Rich McClear. So we had three sort of Sitkins very much influencing the future of the media development in South Sudan.
Well, have you once you got the operation funded and created, has your involvement have you pulled back since and sort of gone on to other projects?
Yeah, I've done a ton of similar projects around the world. I sort of maintain contact with the person in Juba who was, from the USAID side managing the project. But John's done a great job. That he ended up establishing a formal partnership with what is now a full-fledged University of Juba. And the students who are interested in getting into radio go through a rotation, and as far as I understand, they get exposed to management, production, journalism, and advertising. So sort of not development in the sense of getting donations, but just and actually there is no such thing as the mentality of advertising on media in the country. It's just they have to create that mentality and get the people to sign on for
Right.
things. Yeah.
Let me ask you about the Raven Radio model. When you were working for USAID and you set this up, you had Raven Radio kind of pictured in your mind?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean,
How?
the Raven Radio really defined what a good community radio station can be. You know, the kinds of programs that people would do here with limited resources. Over the years of growing up here, you just saw a lot of creativity coming in on urban radio. And when we would talk about doing, for example, a travel program without traveling, when Barb Morris would just be connected to the community such that she knew someone had been somewhere interesting and bring them in, I would often use that as an example of what you can do with community media. Yeah.
And how do you explain it to people? I mean, how can you explain Raven Radio without to someone who hasn't experienced it?
We talk about a radio station being for the community, by the community, in the community, sort of the community. And, you know, so we would think about placing community radio stations close to the center of town where people can just walk in, you know, with their issues or their little advertisements. A lot of radio stations around the world exist on the happy birthday mom sort of $1 per advertisement sort of model. You know, I think that the issues, the public interest mission that Raven Radio has is also something such that it leads to your covering of issues which are missed maybe by mainstream media. That was that was very foundational in my understanding of what needed to be done. When we were in Tajikistan, when I was running that project by Internews, we had a program in which we were supposed to found 6 new radio stations around the country. And it was just sort of when a lot of these color revolutions were happening, and the government was very wary of an American-funded American organization going around founding media in the country. And so they weren't giving us licenses. and they actually never did give the licenses. But in the meantime, what we did was train up the journalists from these 6 would-be stations. And we partnered with an existing station that had a license. And so we did coordinated reporting. Okay, this week we're going to talk about domestic violence, or we're going to talk about leftover nuclear material from the Soviet Union that's out in the open, and care for the aging. You know, these like very important social issues that nobody was covering in the country. And I remember one really strong memory is when we did these sort of story enhanced talk shows. They'd be an hour long where they would have experts in the studio and bring people in who knew that subject matter. And then they would play a story. They'd talk about it, and they play a story from somewhere else in the country and talk about it. And then there was some, you know, ability to call in, you know, from on the part of the public. And when we did that hour for the domestic violence episode, 45 to 50 people called in, and they said, "Hey, I know somebody, my friend, my sister, my cousin is having some issues." And then 11 people, they'd never announced the address of the radio station on the air, but 11 people found the radio station to come in to seek help for someone that they knew that was a victim. And it was on the 11th floor of a building where the elevator didn't work because of 1 hour of programming.
Wow. Up they came.
Yeah.
It's interesting to hear you talk about it, because I often say during our pledge drives that this kind of thing doesn't happen by accident. I mean, Raven Radio is no accident. The model was established by people like Rich McClear, who had this idea that news coverage should be kind of a bottom-up kind of thing. I mean, you have to go to government officials and things, but the people that you serve are also a part of your product as well. And it's just interesting and reassuring to hear that it's kind of gotten these little toeholds out there in the world, because people from Sitka have, you know, like you and Rich and John Newstrom have become involved and somehow talked, you know, sold the model to your funding organizations.
Yeah. I mean, it's really influenced countries to East Timor, to Zimbabwe, Afghanistan. These are all the places where I worked on these issues. In Zimbabwe, it's really interesting. They have no independent broadcast media, TV or radio, and they haven't for 30 years.
All state-controlled.
All state-owned media. There was a studio, though, that was doing news, but sort of on an irregular basis, and they were doing a lot of music production. And when I took a look at their situation, I said, "Look, you guys need to be a radio station, and then what we're going to do is we're going to email your stuff out of the country and broadcast it back in via shortwave, and you'll have a contract with somebody outside the country, like in Botswana or something." And they did that, and so effectively, I mean, it wasn't FM, so of course the signal wasn't as good, but they became a community radio station And they had a lot of the similar setup that you guys do, just with using shortwave instead.
If the vacuum is strong enough, it will draw in content, even that kind of roundabout way. Troy, I don't want to keep you all day, but I am curious if you feel that your station in the South Sudan, is it stable? I mean, was this just something that you helped get going and you have to let it sink or swim? Or what do you think the future holds for this kind of model in that new country?
I think that it already has established a reputation as the best source of news and reporting on what's going on in the South. Because they have correspondents around the South. And keep in mind that they have to report in multiple languages. I think there are there are more than a dozen languages in South Sudan. I think they picked the main six. The reality is that the economy, the means of support of an effort like that are going to be donor-funded for the near future. There's still a lot of instability. There's inter-tribal strife in the South. There are disagreements with the North over oil flows and revenues and stuff like that. So while it's great that the country after war separated peacefully, it's been a bit of a rocky road since independence. And the economy is kind of growing in an odd way. There's a lot of very expensive imports, and average people aren't participating in the booming part of the economy. And for a radio station like that, I think it's you need the media to be part of that sort of birth of country process, if that's the way you can say it. And so it's very likely that donors will continue to recognize its value and continue to fund it until some sort of more stable economy and maybe larger, more healthy economy might be able to support it with domestic resources. And by the way, I'm now working at the World Bank, and I actually might go back and do a very similar assessment and design for them, ironically. So.
All right, Troy Edelin, thanks very much for coming in.
All right, thanks for having me.